Good morning. I consider it a privilege to be here. And because you're here, it's also been a great pleasure. In the 11th chapter of Hebrews, the Apostle Paul paints for us a marvelous collage of the Old Testament people of God. The men and women that he refers to, and some of whom he names, were each incredible in their own lives. They lived in different lands. They lived in different cultures. Their lives actually spanned a period of 4,000 years. Nowhere in the annals of literature, classical or modern, are there stories like the histories of God's people. Paul calls them a cloud of witnesses. It's a multitude that's visible and that surrounds us down to this day. Something made those people unique. Most of them were poor. Paul says that they wandered in sheepskins and goatskins. But you know, there were a few of them that were actually downright wealthy. Most of them were men. But there were a few women mentioned. Most of them were Israelites. But some lived even before the nation of Israel existed. Some of them were heathens. There were even some Moabites. There were even Canaanites in that cloud of witnesses. There were priests, kings, prophets, judges, but there were also widows. They shared something. They shared some qualities, some characteristics that made them what they were. You could have put them anywhere at any time. They would have been the same. Didn't matter if they were in Egypt or in Syria. It didn't matter if they were living in the period of the judges or during the Babylonian captivity. It didn't matter if they were in the courts of Pharaoh or working in the administrative offices of Nebuchadnezzar. It didn't matter where they were. They were unique. They would have been heroes of faith anywhere. They had generic qualities, godlike qualities, rare qualities, qualities that I hope still exist today. Where shall we start? I think there was one basic, primary, required characteristic that they all shared that came before all others. We see it in a very touching, almost dramatic sense in the story of a woman, one who was highlighted by Paul in the 11th chapter of Hebrews. She was unusual in many respects. First of all, she was unusual to be mentioned out of that culture and time because she was a woman. Secondly, she was unusual because she was not an Israelite. She came from an incredibly heathen culture that sacrificed human beings to their gods. And thirdly, from our perspective, she was unusual because the scriptures say she was a prostitute. She was unique. We speak, of course, of Rahab, the Canaanite. This is in Joshua, the second chapter, in verse 9. And we see in the story of this incident that first unique quality. Second chapter, verse 9, from the New English. Rahab speaks, "I know that the Lord has given this land to you." She was speaking to the spies as they came to Jericho. Verse 10, "We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea." That was kind of amazing. That had happened 40 years earlier on the other side of the peninsula. But they had heard. And here it is in verse 11. "The Lord, your God, is God in heaven above and on the earth below." That's it. She and all the cloud of witnesses, before anything else, believed in the one God. Do you have any idea what a rarity that was? To believe in one God. All the other cultures for that entire period of time had a multiplicity of gods. They had sun gods, moon gods, tree gods, river gods, mountain gods. They had gods they made out of stone, out of wood, out of gold, out of silver. They had monumental gods. They had portable gods. They had little pocket gods. Multiple gods. Some of the cultures had 20, 30 gods. Some only had 10. Some boiled it down to 5. Some cultures had 3 gods. It was only here and there, out of that incredible mass and babble of humanity, that you could find anyone who believed in one God. Do you start to see the parallel to the gospel age? Their one God was unique. He was powerful. He was wise. He was righteous. And yet at the same time, this incredibly powerful being was like their friend. Exodus 33:11, "And God spake unto Moses face to face, like a man speaks to his friend." The unique God, unique in that he was one, unique in that he was their friend. They could see this. They could see the difference. They could see his righteousness. They could see that he knew the difference between right and wrong. They could see it in his judgments. They could see his friendship. This wasn't a God that tortured people. This wasn't a God that created the earth in vain. This wasn't a God that was only going to save a few people. Of all these things, they were witnesses. That's why they were called the witnesses. The cloud of witnesses. They witnessed what God was like. If for no other reason, they were different because of their God. Their God, the belief in their God, made them different. The more they believed in Him, the more different it made them. And as they followed Him, the gap between them and their fellow men widened. They were so moved by what they saw that they changed their lives. Changed how they lived. Changed their standards of morality. It changed their motivations. In a very basic sense, their belief in the one God made them what they were. The second distinguishing quality that this great cloud had was something we call righteousness. It was a direct result of their belief in God. Even Ezekiel saw it. From our perspective, Ezekiel is right in the middle of the cloud. But in his day, he was looking backward to the earlier parts of the cloud. And he saw three righteous men. This is in the 14th chapter of the book of Ezekiel. He mentions it both in verse 14 and in verse 20. And he names three men: Noah, Daniel, and Job. The essence of the story is that these three men were saved because they were righteous. And we see that story in all of them. But let's look at Daniel's story, just briefly, in the third chapter. We see that Daniel had so distinguished himself amongst the administrators of this kingdom of Babylon that the king planned to set him, former Hebrew slave, over the entire kingdom. It was a universal kingdom. Here's the account from the New International. At this, they tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of the government. But they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him. Finally, they said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man unless it has something to do with the laws of his God." Daniel was righteous. They couldn't find any charges. And even though the record shows that this cloud of witnesses were not perfect, they still had an incredibly clear perception of what righteousness was. They knew the difference between right and wrong, and they chose to do right. Men like Joseph, Noah, Job, women like Hannah and Elizabeth. Righteousness was the fabric of their lives. They were trying to adopt, to the best of their ability, the characteristics of their God. They tried to be like Him just as much as they could. Do you see the parallel to the gospel age? There must be a parallel in our lives. There must be righteousness. We must know the difference between good and evil. And we must choose to do good. It's very primary. It's basic. We must have morality of the highest standard. There's to be no appearance of evil. No evil speaking. No evil surmising. We must speak only the truth. The righteousness of these people led directly to the third characteristic. Righteousness, my dear brethren, leads directly to affliction. There is no way Satan will tolerate any attempts at righteousness without a strong counterattack. James, in the 5th chapter and verse 10, speaks of the cloud of witnesses in this manner. He says, consider the prophets as an example of suffering affliction. Oh, of course, this is what Paul is speaking about largely in the 11th chapter. The cloud of witnesses endured considerable amounts of affliction. Cruel mockings, scourgings. Paul says, bonds and imprisonments. They were tortured. They were afflicted. They were stoned. Actually sawn asunder. But again, this group was unique. They were special. It wasn't just that they suffered affliction. Every person on the face of the earth has suffered affliction. Thousands of people have been stoned. Thousands of people have died by the sword. This group suffered in a special way. We can't miss that lesson. There's a great example again in Daniel, the 3rd chapter. Nebuchadnezzar is furious with 3 of his foreign advisors. 3 of the Hebrews have refused to worship his God. We see in the 17th verse, chapter 3, the response from these 3 Hebrew men. The God we serve is able to deliver us, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, we want you to know that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up. We see the beauty of their suffering, that it had to do with their religious beliefs. And secondly, it's incredible that in that period of time, they were living in the Spirit. The threat of corporal punishment, the threat of being thrown into a furnace, being incinerated, didn't faze them at all. They did not worship their God because he was going to save them. They didn't worship their God because he was going to make them rich or keep them healthy or in any sense protect them from suffering and from pain. The world still doesn't understand that. The world doesn't understand suffering at all. They see the suffering of this present evil world is irrational. They cannot harmonize that with a God of goodness. It doesn't make any sense to them. We understand the sufferings of the world, but I'm not so sure we understand the sufferings of the church. With the ancients, only one kind of suffering counted. It was suffering for righteousness. There must be a parallel. We must suffer for righteousness. 1 Peter 3:14. So much of our suffering is for our own mistakes and our imperfections. 1 Peter 4:16. If any man suffer as a Christian, let him not be ashamed. 2 Timothy 3:12. All who will live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. Suffering in traffic jams, suffering under a tyrant boss, suffering because of food, water, because the computer failed, suffering because of our own self-will, is nothing more than what the world experiences every day. When we suffer for our own mistakes, it's like Peter said in 1 Peter 2:20 from Moffat. Where is the credit in taking punishment for having done wrong? It's when you do well and suffer. This is acceptable to God. End of quote. So it's a special kind of suffering. It's for Christ. It's for righteousness. It's for His name's sake. And you know, the character development that's supposed to come from suffering, it's not automatic. Suffering does not necessarily result in an improved or ennobled character. We must understand the process of suffering and the purpose of the suffering. Brethren, the usual fleshly reaction to suffering from the worldly point of view is to make a person bitter. What has suffering done for the world? Suffering makes people petty. Suffering makes people vindictive. But on the cloud of witnesses, it had a different effect. It had a beautiful effect. It had a crystallizing effect. There must be a parallel. What are the sufferings and the afflictions of today doing for you? If you feel any pettiness, if you feel vindictive, if you feel bitter, then the afflictions are not having their intended purpose. As fiery as the experiences are, we must control our reactions and our emotions. Even while we're being battered about the head and shoulders by some evil speaking, we must control ourselves and say, "This is good. This is what I wanted. This is what I need to crystallize me." Have you ever been sawn asunder? Of course, there are verbal buzzsaws. Have you ever been stoned? Of course. In your life, there must be a parallel to the cloud of witnesses. And when you realize it's for righteousness, when you realize you're suffering for a purpose, when you realize that there's a connection to Colossians 1:24, and that in some small way we are completing that which is lacking in the afflictions of Christ, and that it's the second step of that great sin offering process, when you realize all those things, you know that the afflictions are for a noble purpose. The next distinguishing characteristic of the great cloud of witnesses is also mentioned by James in the 5th chapter in the 10th verse. James' second point, in the King James, he says that the prophets, the cloud of witnesses, had patience. It's not a very good translation. What it really means, in most cases we find patience in the New Testament, it means cheerful endurance. Not here. The prophets, the cloud of witnesses, suffered long. Long suffering is what James is talking about. They adapted that idea from their God. Their God was a God who suffered long. Numbers 14:18 says that their God was slow to anger. And in Psalms 85:15, Thou, O Lord, art a God of compassion, gracious, and long-suffering. They were imitating their God. I love this Greek word for long-suffering. It comes from, it's a combination of two words. The first is makro. The second is themia. Makro we use in English. It means big. It's the opposite of micro. Themia, besides meaning suffering, it means passion. You know, a good definition of passion is love. We'll say that someone has a passion for food, or we'll talk about an artist. He has a passion for his art, or someone has a passion for music. It means they love it. They can't get enough of it. Day and night, that's all they want to do. That fits the cloud. The cloud had macro passion for God. They couldn't get enough of it. Didn't matter what they experienced, they wouldn't have had it any other way. Direct opposite is to pull back. Revelation 2:4. Some start good, and then they draw back. They lose the first love. Long suffering, long passion. Absolutely none of the stories in Hebrews 11 in the Old Testament are short stories. They served God for their entire lives. What a distinguished group, this cloud of witnesses. Belief in one God. They were righteous. They suffered for righteousness. And they had long passion. There are more features. We don't have time to spend a lot of time on them. They believed in the promises. Men like Joseph. He said, when I die, make sure you take my bones back to the promised land. Jacob believed in the promises. They were ambassadors for God. Think of what good ambassadors the prophets were. Think of what an incredible ambassador John the Baptist was. He was in the cloud. They were dedicated. Women like Ruth, the Moabitess. They worked hard, like Noah. Long time working. And they were also human, like David. They are there for you to parallel. You know, an incredible amount of human behavior is copied. I hate to say that it's a case of monkey see, monkey do, but that has pretty much been the history of mankind. Children learn their role in society by copying their parent or their teacher. Men learn how to be a husband by copying their father. Girls learn how to be a mother by copying what their mother did. We copy mannerisms, styles. We copy words from other people. We copy lifestyles. Nowadays, they call this concept role models. When children have good role models, they grow up and have inside them characteristics and qualities that are also good. When the role models are absent, or if they're immoral, then the children grow up in confusion and evil. The sociologists today decry the present deterioration of the family unit. Because the role models are gone. In this single parent family, one person has to play all the roles. He or she is the father. At the same time, he or she is the mother. They say it's an increasing problem for the children. They're confused. Is this my mother? Is this my father? The world recognizes that one of the factors that's deteriorating present-day society is the lack of role models. Do you see a parallel in the church? Are we gradually losing our role models? We need role models at every level. The Apostle Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11:1, "Be ye followers of me as I follow Christ." The Greek word here, follower, means to imitate. Paul is saying, imitate me as I imitate Christ. You know how children imitate everything. They imitate their parents. They imitate other children. Anything they see, cartoon characters, they imitate quickly. We need good role models. The Apostle Paul is our role model. The cloud has been given to us as our role models. The thing that's so important about the cloud is that they show us what levels of attainment are humanly possible. We always look to our Lord. But you know what the devil does? He whispers in our ear, "Jesus was perfect. You're only human." But the cloud of witnesses were human. And they show us what incredible acts and lives can be done on the human level. And so we have the 11th chapter of Hebrews. The most eloquent tribute ever written about the men and women of God. Let me read a few excerpts. "Faith is the substance of things hoped for, and by it the ancients received a good report." 4. "By faith, Abel offered a more excellent sacrifice, by the which he obtained witness that he was righteous." 7. "By faith, Noah, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, prepared an ark to the saving of his house." 8. "By faith, Abraham, when he was called, he went out, not knowing whither he went." 24. "By faith, Moses refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a while." 32. "And what shall I more say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, and Samuel, and of the rest of the cloud." 37. "They were stoned, sawn asunder, tempted, slain with a sword, wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy." 13 and 39. "And all of these, despite having obtained a good report, died in the faith, not having received the promise." 40. "Because God provided some better thing for you and me." The parallels must be there, my dear brethren. As Paul wrote this, the parallels were there, even in his lifetime. Oh, the stories were a little different, but the sacrifices were just as great. The faith was strong. The afflictions were just as deep. The names changed. As Paul was writing this account of the early cloud, a second version was being enacted in his lifetime. But now, the sacrifice was covenanted. The life was consecrated. It was unto death. And the promise of restitution was given up. Because now, these were sufferings and afflictions of the Spirit begotten. So in a living sense, new names were being plugged into this 11th chapter. Now faith is the basis of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. For by faith, the brethren of the early church obtained a good report. By faith, Barnabas offered unto God a more excellent sacrifice than Ananias and Sapphira. By faith, Philip went out preaching, not knowing whither he was going. By faith, Lydia, the seller of purple, received strength to begin an ecclesia in a heathen land. By faith, Saul refused to be called a Pharisee of the Pharisees and chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God. These all died in the faith. They saw the promises. They were persuaded of them. And they confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. End of quote. If the prize is so much greater, could the sufferings be any less? No. The experiences of the little flock will surpass, I dare say, the experiences of the cloud of witnesses. Barnabas gave everything while he was living. Peter, James, and John left their businesses. They suffered worthily, not for their own mistakes, they suffered for Christ. What an increasing cloud of witnesses we have from the early church. Paul said of the Old Testament group that the world was not worthy of them. The same thing could be said for Paul himself. The world wasn't worthy of Paul. The world wasn't worthy of Barnabas and Lydia. And we cannot escape the parallel. We must strive. We must strive that that same expression can be used of us. If we have to live in sheepskins and goatskins, if we have to live in the mountains, in the caves, in the deserts, as they did, then so be it. They were unique. That cloud. And so are you. You are unique. If you ever wonder, why was I called? Why was I blessed? Let me tell you. On a very basic level, it's because you believe in the one God. You haven't confused it with a multiplicity of gods. You believe in righteousness. You know the difference between right and wrong. And despite your feeble flesh, you're trying every day to do what's right. Nothing will shorten your long-lived passion. You've committed until death. And so, the 11th chapter of Hebrews is being rewritten today. It's a 20th century translation. And on this one, allow me a little poetic license. Faith is the basis of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. By faith, Charles Taze Russell, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, sold his business and became an heir of righteousness. By faith, Chester and Cora Sundbaum offered God a more excellent sacrifice. By faith, Brother Fisher of Germany, when he was tried, continued to labor for the German brethren. By faith, Wilf Price sojourned as in a strange country because he was a pilgrim. By faith, Elizabeth Campbell of Wales refused to remain in the society and lost her family because she judged him faithful who had promised. And what shall I say more? For time would not fail me to tell of others. And I hesitate, not because of time really, but I don't know the names. But I am convinced, dear brethren, that the Lord is now writing another version of Hebrews 11. The cloud of witnesses are examples, but the members of the church are being chosen now. They will offer a more excellent sacrifice. They will die in the faith. They will refuse to be called anything but the sons of God. They will work. They will be generous. They will sacrifice. The stories will be sadder. They will be more touching. The afflictions deeper and longer. And finally, it will be said of them that they endured the cross. They despised the shame. They are set down at the right hand of the throne of God. My prayer is that that might be said of you.